1606 was a seminal year for England and for William Shakespeare, its premier playwright. The country was struggling with the plague and the aftermath of the gunpowder plot, a failed attempt to blow up Parliament, and it was being ruled by the Scottish King James following the death of Queen Elizabeth, leading it to be rife with political and religious divisions and wrestling with questions of unification. But during that single year, the bard finished writing King Lear and then created two other tragedies, Macbeth and Antony and Cleopatra. James Shapiro, a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University and a specialist in Shakespeare in the early modern period, has called his latest book The Year of Lear. In it, he places these three great works into the context of British history. We spoke last month, and now we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you. I began by asking Professor Shapiro, we tend to think of Shakespeare as an Elizabethan writer. Is that an accurate description, since he did produce more works under Queen Elizabeth than King James?
Shakespeare's career really falls into two parts. He started writing plays either in the late 1580s or right around 1590, and up until 1603, he was an Elizabethan playwright. In that year, Queen Elizabeth died. King James VI came down from Scotland and was coronated, King James I, for the last decade of his career, in which he wrote some of his most extraordinary tragedies and romances. Shakespeare was a Jacobean playwright and a member of the company that King James called the King's Men.
So why do you think he is not thought of as much in that context? Is it that despite all of James's accomplishments, including the King James Bible and the establishment of a permanent colony in America, he doesn't get the same kind of respect that the Tudors got?
People love the Tudors. People love Queen Elizabeth, movies, films, TV shows.
No, there's no Jacobean television series. There's no Tudors.
And Shakespeare in Love doesn't end with King James solving the problems. It's always Queen Elizabeth. The English fell out of love with King James probably in 1606 and have been out of love with him ever since.
As I said, 1606 was a difficult and unsettling year for England and a very productive one for Shakespeare. How are those two facts related?
It was a terrible year for England, as you said. There's plague, there's political and religious divisions. There had been a failed terrorist attack. People were trying to make sense of it. It was a great year for Shakespeare.
Plague had affected his family?
It affected everyone in England. And the aftermath of the gunpowder plot affected his hometown, where there was an insurrection, actually, short-lived, to overthrow the government and restore Catholicism.
That was the Guy Fawkes thing, right?
That's right.
And the English still celebrate Guy Fawkes Day.
November, the 5th of November. We just see the Guy Fawkes mask at protests today, and that's the legacy in America. But if you think about what it meant to have narrowly avoided a catastrophic terrorist attack that would have eliminated the political and religious leadership and maybe blown up 30,000 citizens in London out of a population of 200,000, the country was rocked by this. And the early months of 1606, stretching into the early summer, were involved with rounding up, torturing, trying, and publicly eviscerating and cutting to pieces these terrorists.
Do we see that reflected in subtle ways in the plays?
In sometimes not so subtle ways. Macbeth is a gunpowder play. From the opening moments when the witches come out and there are smells of gunpowder from the stage effects, and the central word of that play, equivocation, is a buzzword from this moment.
And it's his only Scottish play.
It is his only Scottish play, although Shakespeare starts writing British plays after King James comes to the throne. Under Elizabeth, English identity had been the obsession.
Or Italian sources, a lot of Italian plays.
He's always using Italian sources, but in the second half of his career, whether it's Cymbeline, King Lear, or Macbeth, he's writing about Britain because King James wanted to unite his kingdoms into one. And in this year, he pushed hard for that and failed miserably.
At the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign, wasn't Shakespeare's troops struggling because they, in effect, had lost their patron, Lord Chamberlain? Did they have to make adjustments, political adjustments?
We like to think of Shakespeare's career as a slow, steady, triumphant victory lap, and it wasn't. He had highs and lows like any writer. And one of the challenges for Shakespeare after writing such a great play as Hamlet was to find his footing again, especially in the new regime. And it took him a few years to do that. 1606 is when he does that.
His troop gets appointed the King's Men by King James. What did that mean?
First thing it meant was Shakespeare was issued 4.5 yards of red cloth to make livery, or what our doormen wear, basically. He had to attend upon the court as a groom of the chamber. It also meant having to perform at court 10 times a year, but it made his company the most prestigious in the land.
Although you say he never did masks, they were popular pageants that other playwrights did?
You know, it's like a musician saying, I'm not going to do halftime at the Super Bowl. It's just not my thing. Shakespeare was financially successful. He was artistically successful, but there were certain things he wouldn't do.
How much did you imagine that the historical archives would enhance your understanding of the plays that Shakespeare wrote during this time, or that his plays would illuminate the politics of the time when you began writing this book?
I had written an earlier book about the year 1599, and that had taken me 15 years to research. I didn't know how long this one was going to take. I knew that it would be some time. And it's a slow, steady accumulation of pieces of information, the weather, the politics, whatever it is that help us understand what the forces were that shaped Shakespeare as he created these plays.
Well, these are great plays, but it's interesting to note that there was political censorship of plays at the time. And Ben Jonson was put in prison as a punishment for a reference he made humorously to Scottish lords.
Yeah, you know, you had to be careful when you made fun of Scots, especially when there was a King of Scots. And one of Shakespeare's great gifts was he walked the line. People wanted political drama. They just didn't want to see their playwrights jailed. And many in the theater community suffered at this time.
Well, he had started writing Lear before 1606, but it's a play about the problems of not being a country, kingdom not being unified.
This was one of those moments where a play begun in the autumn of 1605 gets overtaken by the events once Guy Fawkes and his fellow plotters try and fail to destroy the kingdom. It's a play that we learn about the divisions of the kingdom in the opening lines. So it became clearly a very timely and topical play.
But hadn't there been a previous King Lear, spelled a little differently, L-E-I-R, written by, we're not exactly sure who?
Shakespeare knew. We don't. Imagine we were theatergoers in the 1590s, and one of our favorite plays was King Lear, L-E-I-R. It's a great play. It's about a king with his three daughters who divides his kingdom. And at the end, he has his kingdom restored to him, and he's reconciled with his youngest daughter.
Happy ending.
Happy ending. So you said to me, let's go see Shakespeare's version of this. We love that happy ending. And we get to the end of the play, and we're expecting that reconciliation. And all of a sudden, Cordelia's dead, Lear's dead, Gonald Reagan dead. It's like everybody's hit by a truck at the end of that play. It must have been shocking to audiences.
Do you think Shakespeare appeared in the earlier version?
We don't know. He had tremendous powers of memory, but almost surely he was working from a version of that play printed in late 1605.
But you have to wonder why he would draw from a source like that. As I said, you know, earlier, it was either English history or Italian literature. Hamlet takes place in Denmark. But this seems to me to be kind of dangerous territory.
Shakespeare made up almost none of his plots, as you say, Italian romance history. He was the greatest reviser in history. Hamlet, Henry V. Many of these are old stories, especially Elizabethan plays that he did gut renovations of, none more so than King Lear.
And really, the topic here is unification, which was important to King James, but only Parliament could really affect it.
King James.
What happened to the divine right of kings?
King James believed in it. Parliament didn't. King James went before Parliament and said, look, I'm married to two kingdoms. Don't make me a bigamist. Let's unite these kingdoms. Let's create this flag, the Union Jack. And he created an identity crisis that didn't exist before, and Shakespeare was great at exploring those.
Well, is it fair to say that Shakespeare's plays about English history were intended to define the English identity?
Absolutely. And they still define it. You go to a production of Henry V in London and watch the crowds, and you're watching English identity confirmed once again.
And now we're talking about something different, British identity. Were people even using the word British at that point?
They had begun to, and it begins to feed into Shakespeare's work. King Lear is the first play in which Shakespeare uses that term, British, And people are struggling with trying to understand, can I be English and British? What happens if you're born in one place and living in the other? There weren't a lot of Scots living in England at this time, and there was great suspicion about that. And in Europe right now, we're watching England and Scotland pull apart. So what began in 1605, 1606 is now untangling.
My guest is James Shapiro, the Larry Miller Professor of English at Columbia University, author of five previous books on Shakespeare, and now the sixth one, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with a special rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Columbia University Professor James Shapiro about his latest book, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. I continued our conversation by asking, you say that each time we hear the word British in King Lear, it's a little off. What do you mean?
I smell the blood of a British man. I think audiences were waiting for English man. So it's a bit of a joke on Shakespeare's part. I think he's pointing to the ways in which everybody had best be used to thinking of themselves as not just English but British.
And what about the word nothing and the concept of nothing? Why is that central to Shakespeare's Lear?
Shakespeare was reading this old play of King Lear, L-E-I-R, and he casually overuses the word nothing. I think Shakespeare heard that word and he thought, I can make something out of nothing. And it becomes the baseline of this work, part of the music of the play. Nothing comes of nothing. Speak again. Up to that very final and cruel never, never, never at the end of the play when Lear is reflecting on the totality of his loss.
It almost feels nihilistic.
It is. It's almost like Beckett, about 400 years ahead of Beckett. And the play was so dark that Shakespeare or others working in his company pulled back a bit from that ending. And when it was republished 15 years after its first publication, Lear is allowed to die deluded, thinking his daughter is still alive, rather than the absolute eviscerating earliest version.
Do we know what reaction audiences had to that ending, which is so powerful and feels so contemporary?
It does, and we don't.
Now, what is Harsnett's declaration of egregious popish impostors, and how did it influence King Lear?
It's the longest unusable title imaginable. It is a work about the ways in which young women were forced to drink potions and begin to profess that they were possessed by devils. This was a culture obsessed with witches and devils, and it's an expose of that.
And James himself published a book about witchcraft called Demonology. We're talking about 90 years before the Salem witch trials. Do we see the legacy of this on what happened in New England 90 years later?
Absolutely. That culture, you know, in 1606, late 1606, the first ship sailed to found the first permanent colony in America. These were the people who shaped our culture. And while we look at the Year of Lear and Shakespeare in Jacobean England as a different culture, it's the roots of our own.
In previous visits here, we've talked about how Shakespeare wrote these plays with actors in mind. Did that apply here as well?
It did, but to a lesser extent. I think Shakespeare is still acting, certainly at court with his company, but the few documents that we have suggest that he was no longer touring with his company and perhaps not working with them on the daily basis. That caused Shakespeare to really have to work incredibly hard, rehearsing a play in the morning, performing it in the afternoon, reading and writing late into the night. He's in his 40s now, and I think they cut him some slack.
During this time, his writing was criticized by people like Ben Jonson and John Dryden for being too dense, knotty, and deliberately obscure. So he obviously was a controversial figure.
He was, and he wasn't going to write the same play each time, and he certainly wasn't going to write in the same style. These three great tragedies, Lear, Macbeth, and Antony and Cleopatra, couldn't be more different stylistically or in any other way from each other.
Now, the members of Parliament were warned about the gunpowder plot, and then they found this letter, and Shakespeare makes a reference to the letter?
You know, it's a chicken and egg question. Shakespeare happens to embed in King Lear the very sort of found letter that exposes a conspiracy. Did he write that and the truth happened 3 months later, or did it work the other way? It's like those 9/11 movies that came out or were finished shooting 2 months before the attacks on the World Trade Center.
There was also a theft of 10 horses from a stable in Warwick on November 6th. And that was related to the conspiracy, but Shakespeare was kind of close to that theft.
Way too close. His next-door neighbor, George Badger, was the bagman holding Catholic relics who was arrested after the failed uprising. His land abutted the planning house for the terrorist attack. The depot for arms was 4 miles north of his house in Stratford. So he knew both people on some people on both sides of this failed attack.
Another writing of the time plays a role in all of this, the Treatise of Lying and Fraudulent Equivocation.
That is an extraordinary document that I had a chance to hold at the Bodleian Library in Oxford a year or so ago. It is a how-to manual for Catholics, training them to lie to the authorities. And after the failure of the gunpowder plot, the authorities searched the lodgings of all the plotters and found this, and it became Exhibition A at the trial. It's about equivocation, saying one thing and meaning or thinking something else, and it feeds right into Macbeth.
And before Macbeth, the word equivocation appeared only once in a play by Shakespeare, in Hamlet. Does it mean the same thing to Shakespeare as it does to us today?
It didn't mean the same thing in Hamlet as it would in Macbeth. In Hamlet, it's used neutrally. Something is ambiguous. In Macbeth, it has this sinister connotation that we now use.
Should I assume that the reason that the central action of Macbeth, the killing of the Scottish king happening offstage, was a result of political sensitivity? Because he has Julius Caesar killed on stage.
You cannot kill a Scottish king on stage. King James was plagued with assassination attempts. There were more talks of them later in the year, rumors of them. He lived in dread of being assassinated.
And isn't it true that the word assassination appeared for the first time in Macbeth?
It did. Every school kid now knows what that word means, but audiences hearing Macbeth in his first great soliloquy use that long word would have been turning to each other on the globe. Assassination?
Mm. In immediately after Duncan's murder offstage, Shakespeare has a scene where a hungover porter responds slowly to the continuous knocking at the door. What were the different reactions to that scene at the time?
People love comic relief, and it's a brilliant move. Just as Lady Macbeth and Macbeth are scurrying back to their room after killing King Duncan, a drunken guy comes in and complains about being hungover. And he starts talking about equivocation. So it's double-edged. In one way, he's clowning. In another, he talks directly to the central driving element of the play that's informing every character's reactions.
One interpretation is that he was guarding the gate of hell. Can the evil in Macbeth be attributed to occult influences? Because we have witches as major characters in the play.
That is the question of the play. Does the evil begin with us, or is it satanic in origin? And that's a question that became very central after a failed attack on the Order of the Gunpowder Plot. What made these people want to kill so many people?
Shakespeare is looking into the evil that men do in Macbeth.
He is, and that's why the play still speaks to us 400 years later.
Macbeth equivocates more and more as the play goes on. He liked those kinds of characters. Obviously, Hamlet was an earlier version.
Hamlet, Iago, Richard III, Shakespeare knew
these
what equivocation
people.
Was. They are, and they're people who understand how to use language brilliantly to deceive others. But the evil is a separate question. We don't know whether Edmund the Bastard in King Lear is evil by nature or he's evil because of the bad hand he's been dealt with in life. And Shakespeare does not answer that question but forces it on us.
He's somebody who we see changing, adjusting to the situations at hand. And anybody recognizes characters like that in the politics of any day. How are the politics of the time reflected in Anthony and Cleopatra?
By the time Shakespeare's writing Antony and Cleopatra, and by this time, the idea of unifying England and Scotland is not going to happen. And there's a sense when Queen Elizabeth was in her late years, in her 70s, everybody was just tired of what they called this old lady ruling them. They wanted us, a young king, a man with children. They didn't want succession hanging over them. They welcomed King James enthusiastically. 3 years into his reign, he's profligate. He doesn't get his people. You can't vote him out of office. You're stuck with this king for perhaps decades to come.
And you're stuck with his kid.
You're stuck with his kids. And Antony and Cleopatra is a celebration of a great queen, and it's a nostalgic, part of a larger nostalgic move, remembering Elizabeth and lamenting their current state.
And would James have taken affront?
I'm not sure James would have really taken in the plays. He much preferred hunting to theater going, but he was no fool. He was a very educated man. I'm not sure he caught all the subtleties of this play, and Shakespeare threw in just enough to flatter him.
Now, on another front, you recently wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about the Oregon Shakespeare Festival's decision to commission 36 playwrights to rewrite Shakespeare's plays. But the plays are kind of difficult for modern audiences to understand, and we don't see Chekhov performed in the original Russian. We see it in translation. Why is it a bad idea to try to update Shakespeare for modern audiences so that they can understand all of the references?
I've heard Shakespeare in Spanish and in Hebrew, Japanese and German.
The Russians say he's a greater playwright in Russian than he is in English.
And so do the Germans. And you know what? He works within those cultures. The problem is you cannot take Shakespeare and turn him into modern language without destroying that which is Shakespearean. I had a letter from a writer after this op-ed ran, whose husband had died of Alzheimer's. And she wrote to me that for the last couple of years of his life, he was unable to really communicate effectively with her. At the very end, he quoted Shakespeare and Othello's words to Desdemona about loving her and what she loved him for, perfectly quoting Shakespeare. And she felt the things you learn that settle in most deeply are the things that stay with you as an Alzheimer's patient. And that, to me, is as good an argument against this plan to dumb down Shakespeare.
Well, you wouldn't change to be or not to be. That is the question.
The question,
which is not really an iambic pentameter. It's 11 beats.
The question really is what's left that Shakespearean. He didn't invent the plots. I mean, you're just restoring them to other kinds of plays rather than Shakespeare. I would rather have those 36 American playwrights write the next Hamilton than take an internet billionaire's money and struggle with Shakespeare unsuccessfully.
Next year will be the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. What kind of celebrations can we expect?
It's going to be huge. The Folger Shakespeare Library is sending first folios to all 50 states and 2 territories. And in New York City at the New York Historical Society, the 92nd Street Y's in on it, the Public Theater, BAM's bringing in the Royal Shakespeare Company. It'll probably be the most exciting Shakespeare year in our city's history.
And we'll be able to see the first folio?
You will be able to see copies of the first folio at the New York Historical Society come April.
You serve as a scholar in residence at New York's Public Theater. What kind of support do you provide for the actors and directors? Because they do take liberties when they perform Shakespeare in the Park.
If I weren't here with you right now, I'd be at Rikers. They're performing at venues all around the city right now where people who don't know Shakespeare get these productions. I'm brought into the room to share my knowledge of 400 years of the culture, to share what I know about the language of Shakespeare, and luckily the Public Theater brings in some of the best actors and directors in the land.
Now, we don't have much time, but we've talked about Shakespeare in 1606. What about the plays that followed? Do they also reflect the politics of the day?
They always do, and there's another great year that I hope another scholar will pick up, 1610, 1611.
Oh, you don't want to do it anymore?
I'm no longer quite as young as I was when I began these last 2 yearbooks. If I have enough stamina, I'll tackle that. But if not, the year that Shakespeare wrote Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale and The Tempest is up for grabs.
It's a pretty good place, but I think that this was a greater year, actually.
It was an amazing
Lear and Macbeth alone.
I agree. Extraordinary.
James Shapiro is the Larry Miller Professor of English at Columbia University. He's the author of five previous books, including Contested Will, who wrote Shakespeare, and he's also the editor of Shakespeare in America. His latest book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.